The campaign rail car of William Jennings Bryan chugged through New Jersey. Its occupant, the Democratic Party candidate for the presidency of the United States, was engaging in something unheard of for its time. Crowds were responding, and as the train went through Orange, New Jersey, inventor Thomas Alva Edison wanted to capture this phenomenon of stumping candidate for the presidency. He brought his kinetograph, which we now would say is a 35-millimeter movie camera, to the railroad stop and captured the candidate in mid-speech so that he could show his image through his vitascope, which we would now call a projector, in theaters all across the country. Thus, in 1896, two innovations met, one in entertainment, the other in politics. Edison's machine would go on to revolutionize the world. Bryan would also revolutionize politics, but his own campaign would meet the resistance of another innovation. The perfection of a type of campaign financing that would create the best financed campaign to date. Yet 1896 wasn't the first the world saw of campaign finance. After his successful election to the presidency, Benjamin Harrison told his campaign manager, "Providence has shone upon us." This did not please Matthew Quay, the Pennsylvania political boss whose prodigious fundraising overwhelmed the opposition. "Providence," Quay said, "the thought of it. Does he not know how many people dodged the penitentiary to elect him?" Quay raised quite a bit, but you won't find any frayed old FEC report to find out how much or whom he raised it from. No federal agency supervised that kind of thing then, and Quay had the good sense to burn the records of the 1888 Harrison campaign. Thus, it has fallen to another 19th century campaign to be the poster child for gobs of money, since the treasurer kept excellent records. Chip Merritt writes on the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics Facebook site, $6 billion and not much changing. I find this pretty remarkable. It makes me wonder, in the past, what was campaign spending like? Did we have eccentric Trump-like characters in the past? Thanks, Chip. I think it's yes and yes. But first, $6 billion should be put in a context, even in the present, as it's a figure of all federal spending. Okay, that includes House, Senate, and the Obama-Romney contest. So, sure, it's a lot of money. I've heard, you know, figures like it's half of FEMA's budget and lots of books for school children could be spent if they were used on that purpose. I'm not sure it is shocking, nor am I sure it is a tragedy. If you were to have a republic of 300-plus million citizens got to reach out to them, the money is not, at least these days, going into voters' pockets. It's for communications to them. And sometimes to the dismay of those in Iowa or Florida, at them. Just to give an example, if I wanted to use the cheapest form and send a letter to 114 million households in the United States, I mean, first-class stamp alone would be 28 million. Yeah, I know I'd probably get bulk rate, but still, you get the point. 28 million just to send one letter. So it's not stamps either. It's TVs, it's rallies, it's internet banners, it's the like. And to some degree, the $6 billion figure says more to me about the cost of an Ohio TV ad than it does just about the raising of the money. $6 billion is a big figure for the average person. But Procter & Gamble, for instance, spent $9 billion on advertising in 2011. That's one company. And the federal budget is $4 trillion. So spending a token of that to determine who will control that budget? You know, put it in a context, I guess, at least. Now, that's the present. It is also not as shocking. In history, 2012 was an expensive election, but not monumentally different in proportion to the same amount of money of the hotly contested elections of history. We'll look at a couple in the 19th century. There's at least one tactic that used today in only a minor way that would be abhorrent to us now that was a regular part of the way money was raised back when. In the midst of the Civil War, a telegram went from the White House to New York political boss Thurlow Weed. "Come down to Washington immediately." When he arrived, President Lincoln had a message. He needed money. "We are in a tight place, Weed. Money for legitimate purposes is needed immediately, and there are no lawful appropriations from which to take it. With the assurance that it was for a legitimate purpose, and a little note that Lincoln wrote to Weed to make it clear to anyone he would raise money from that this was indeed for the president, Thurlow Weed raised it in a day. 1,000 each from 15 important New Yorkers. And it was, as Weed suspected, going to be used in the Connecticut and Vermont and New Hampshire elections of 1863. If these states went Democrat in that year, it would be damaging to the Union effort. The 15,000 is about 260,000 by CPI calculation, often the most conservative calculation in today's money, more by other calculation. But the Copperheads were beaten in key states. The election was tied to the war effort, and the Union prevailed. Lincoln would face a much tougher task in 1864 as he faced re-election. And Democrats were not so clearly Copperhead. They nominated the former commander of Union armies, George McClellan, for Lincoln's Republicans, now renamed the Union Party to show their patriotism and allegiance to the war. This was dangerous. McClellan? He was the commander of Union forces. He promised to fight the war to the finish. Democrats could support him and never be called a rebel sympathizer just because they weren't voting for Lincoln. It was a free and fair election. And now there was a real choice, and things did not look good for the president. But his people got to work. James Harlan, the senator from Iowa, headed up the fundraising team, made use of his franking privileges for a letter to federal employees. The letter was from Henry Raymond, Union Party chairman and publisher of the New York Times. Yes, that line between newspapers and politics was not so clear then as it is now. The Union Party committee, presuming you will esteem it a privilege to do something in aid of a work so vital to our country, have asked you for a figure of, and here there would be a number from $50 to $150, depending on the employee's salary. We also request that you canvass your area for Lincoln and Johnson. These employees weren't the only ones solicited. Anyone who worked at the Customs House were instructed to give 3% of their salary, and each cabinet member was asked for $250. A lot of them paid more. This was not forced. I mean, especially during wartime, the president's reelection was a goal for everyone on the Republican side of politics. But the assessment letters helped to make it clear what was requested. As to what the money was being used for, according to an article in the Indianapolis Journal, the House of Representatives committee rooms were taken over with 100 clerks preparing Lincoln literature for the mails. The post office was busy sending 80 bags of Lincoln literature to the troops. Raymond's effort was effective, but it was not the Lincoln campaign in 1864 that invented these things, not by a long shot. As a new party, the Republicans were even a tad hesitant about this practice of assessments of federal employees. But the practice went as far as Jacksonian days. Indeed, the first attempt to even make it illegal to fundraise from federal employees was in the 1830s by Kentucky Congressman John Bell, and his effort failed. So we knew it was a problem then. One side of the equation was, to the victors go the spoils. And yes, spoilsmen, people seeking offices from the federal government, would bother presidents and other people in the administration for time to come. But the other side of it was, employees would give back from parties that gave them the spoils in order to make the party the victors once again. So when this new Republican Party took over from Democrats in 1861, they wanted to adopt the same model, create a new machine to seek money from federal employees, but there were still a lot of Democrats out there working for the federal government. They were salivating over the $4 million payroll at the naval yards in Brooklyn, Connecticut, Philadelphia. Hitting up the employees would not only raise some campaign funds for pamphlets, newspapers, advertisement, traveling speakers, rallies, all through the loyal states. They could also ferret out the naval yard employees. If they said no, they must be Copperheads, and then they could be fired. For this reason, Navy Secretary Gideon Welles was repulsed by the idea and did everything he could to keep the naval yards clean. Indeed, the naval yards of the United States would be the site of the first campaign finance law. The Naval Appropriations Bill of 1867 banned the solicitation of military officers and naval yard workers. Why had Congress done this? For the purity of the nation? Not exactly. It was because at that time, 1867, this is after Lincoln's assassination, Andrew Johnson became president, was fighting with the radical Republicans in Congress, and there was talk of Johnson fundraising parties in the naval yards. This angered radical Republicans in Congress, and immediately they ended the practice. So 19th century fundraising involved in large part the employees who were being put into job by the government that they were helping to get elected. But there were other sources of money, financiers as well. In 1872, in Grant's re-election, one financier who gave $50,000 bankrolled a quarter of his re-election campaign. One person. That would go a long way to besting Horatio Seymour and giving the general a second term. So while there's no disclosure records, other sources, newspaper accounts, charges of the opposition about the spending, requests from party members for a certain amount of literature and things like this, you can get at the kind of spending that was going on in the 19th century, even absent a government authority collecting all the data on it. It's pretty clear that you're seeing fundraising of the type and level that we see today proportionate to the economy at the time, especially when you consider that the employee assessments, which are not possible now, added even more dollars. To some degree, the Pendleton Act of 1883, passed in the wake of President Garfield's assassination, which was, allegedly, by a disappointed office seeker, took employees out of the party game by putting them into the civil service, and it reduced the amount of employees that could be solicited. When Grover Cleveland became president, he added employees to civil service, so there were 27,000 federal employees who could not be touched. Still, there were state workers, and Pennsylvania political boss Matthew Quay raised a fortune from state contracts and state assemblies. And there were a lot of federal employees who were not in the civil service yet. The president is like an Arab sheikh. One editorial in 1885 wrote, 100 years from now, the country would find it hard to believe that President Cleveland, his Secretary of State, his Secretary of the Treasury, were like these desert chieftains sitting under a tree outside the city gates, doling out individual rewards and punishments, and distributing bounty. I go to bed after a long day with the feeling I must be the meanest man in the world, President Cleveland wrote, for I seem to be saying no, or I would only be too glad to say yes. This office-seeking is a disease. To some extent, the workaholic president did it to himself. Most presidents looked only at the top-tier jobs, those federal jobs that would pay $2,000 or more a year. Good change in the 1800s. Cleveland would get into the fourth class of federal employees, and these would be the small-town postmaster jobs. Nearly 40,000 employees. Then there were another 2,000 larger third-tier postmasterships, 130 council chiefs, 100 custom collectors, 84 revenue collectors, 60 marshals, 20 territorial judges. It was still a tremendous base to pull from in the 19th century for fundraising. Yet Grover the Good couldn't tap into this as well as his predecessors. He had angered the party base, kept a number of Republicans in office, expanded the civil service, and had too many misgivings to send out an assessment letter as Harlan and Raymond had done. Voluntary tithing was still present for those who wished, but as he approached re-election in 1888, Cleveland had trouble raising funds. When Cleveland sought re-election, he would strike a hornet's nest by trying to lower tariffs. This angered the manufacturers who created a 1,000 Defenders of American Industry, each pledging $100 yearly. That's $100,000. For several years during the Cleveland presidency, it supported tariffs, but the implied message was dump President Cleveland. It would put the money to good use, sometimes in subtle ways, like sponsoring essay contests in colleges about why low tariffs would be a bad idea. Again, dump Cleveland. Newspaper missives attacking the low tariff position, speakers going throughout the country, and producing pro-tariff protection papers. There were numerous other organizations the same as the 1,000, including the Protection League. Meanwhile, the Democratic campaign was not well-funded. A free trade association backing the president had little funds. One campaign manager noted in a letter that they couldn't print enough flyers, We had a requisition for Illinois for 500,000 sheets. Of course, we cannot fulfill them, but we will fill some. Indeed, the campaign printed 8 or 9 million pamphlets. Sounds good, but low by the standards of 19th century campaigns. Samuel Tilden, campaigning for the presidency on the Democratic nomination in 1876, printed 27 million. Matthew Quay, leading the GOP effort to beat Cleveland, had no such money problems. He was the absolute boss of the state of Pennsylvania, controlling its governors, its legislature, its state charter banks, which also provided him with loans and extra money, and the U.S. Senate appointments of the state. He controlled almost everything from his mansion in St. Lucie, Florida. In fact, he visited that so much and had Pennsylvanians come down to see him that he was called the third senator from Florida. In 1888, Quay assessed industries who were benefiting from the tariff. And something else. His sometime rival, John Wanamaker, owned 16 department stores in Philadelphia, began a Republican advisory committee of businessmen, limited number, who could raise funds for candidate Harrison in 1888. It's not known how much money Wanamaker raised, but he admitted at one point it was at least $200,000. In total, we won't know how much Quay raised because he set fire to the records. Likely, it was $1.5 million or more, which could have been very meaningful as Cleveland was defeated in a narrow electoral college victory. And there were two sets of improper uses of money that were noted in that campaign. A Republican letter slipped out that they were purchasing floaters, so-called voters that could be bought in Indiana, and that any money paid to them would be reimbursed by the Republican National Committee. Another is that certain bosses in New York, in control of Irish-American wards, were paid indirectly for their service, though the official Tammany Hall organization was backing President Cleveland. There are two important things in politics. One is money, and the other, well, I can't remember what the other one is. Thus spoke Mark Hanna, 19th century money raiser and kingmaker in politics. Working on the Benjamin Harrison effort in 1888, as a lieutenant in Ohio, he would perfect his political fundraising skills, raising $100,000 for President Harrison's campaign. But in 1896, he backed William McKinley, the governor of Ohio and a former House member who had pushed a large tariff, unpopular with Democrats, but loved by industry. Yet, despite having this candidate business loved, initially his fundraising effort in 1896 wasn't going so well. His campaign treasurer, the future Vice President Charles G. Dawes, wrote early on, "The outlook for campaign funds is poor." Yet this would change, as the Democrats would nominate William Jennings Bryan. The Nebraska congressman was a leader of the silver money forces, those who wanted inflationary silver coinage as opposed to a gold standard. He was for low tariffs. So he had two reasons that the manufacturers who wanted protection from high tariffs were against him. Bryan's threat was magnified by his speaking ability and the vigor of his campaign. Nothing like this had been seen. He began a train tour of the Midwest and East. 18,000 miles would be traveled. He'd make 600 speeches. His own estimate is that he spoke to 5 million people. Bryan also had some money backers, silver miners, the financier August Belmont, who was backing Democratic candidates at this time, William Randolph Hearst, whose papers were uniformly for William Jennings Bryan, but it was completely out-fundraised by William McKinley's campaign. "I can't afford to send voters to Nebraska," he said. Indeed, while Bryan would take a train car across the nation, his opponent William McKinley would stay in his house and greet voters who came to visit him on his front porch. It was a tactic. McKinley said there was no way he could outdo Bryan's vow of political poverty. "If I take a first-class car, he'll take a standard car," he said. "If I take a standard car, Bryan will come around in a freight car." Bryan would always look poorer than McKinley, so he decided not to stump at all. However, the Republican National Committee would have voters come to see McKinley. Indeed, 200,000 people would venture to see McKinley in Ohio on his front porch, and many would have their tickets paid or partially subsidized by the Republican National Committee. How did the funds arrive for this? Well, Hanna would assess businesses by their stake in the prosperity of the country. For banks, for instance, this meant 0.25% of their capital. But Hanna had two rules about this assessment. There were no favors to be had in exchange for this. If any money came to him with a request for a favor, it was turned back. And nobody gave more than the assessment. Don't do us any favors. Your business is assessed at this amount. That's how much you give us. Unlike the 1888 campaign, Dawes kept excellent records and did not burn them. And by his accounting and letters to Hanna, the campaign raised $3.5 million by the end. That's nearly $100 million in today's dollars CPI. Two things. Some historians, writers about this election, have doubled that figure when you consider other sources of money, such as state committees. And you have to look at more than CPI when you're assessing campaign funding. The money's not just going to buy milk and eggs. There were only so many people that had $7 million in 1896. So a straight CPI calculation is not the only way to appreciate how much that means in the economy as large. If you use a measure of economic power, that could be as much as $6.8 billion. That $3.5 million, to have that then, would be like having $6.8 billion at your disposal now. The money went for various expenses. One key component of a campaign in the 19th century was to send speakers all around the country stumping for your guy. And since McKinley was on his front porch, he had to have a well-staffed speakers bureau. And indeed, 1896 topped all records for this. Speakers were sent all around from McKinley. Plus, there was literature, educational literature, mostly pamphlets and posters, but also sometimes full-size books, either giving the Republican Party platform, listing the merits of William McKinley and Garrett Hobart, or talking about the anarchy that would result if the Democratic platform were adopted. Red, white, and blue colored posters, Our Home Defenders, McKinley and Hobart, with the platform outline. Pictures of factories open and workers happy. Exultant McKinley on a pedestal with prosperity at home and prestige abroad in big letters. Red, white, and blue silk ribbons and sheet music for the McKinley Man of Destiny March. These were the type of things money went to then. There may have been no TV ads, but about 150 million pieces of 275 different pamphlets were probably sent out during the 1896 McKinley campaign. And don't forget those sound money coins, medals, shot glasses, glass mugs. Bryan felt, in his memoirs, that he was not beaten. He was simply overwhelmed by the opponents. He talked about the factory workers that were given paychecks, that were told, come in on Wednesday only if McKinley's elected. Don't come in if Will Bryan is elected. He told of orders placed at the big factory contingent on McKinley's election. He felt money was the reason that he lost. Now, we're only looking at the 19th century here, and there's a lot of other elections. But I think it demonstrates that things aren't new or different today. 1896 was excessive, but there was a real threat there to make business want to part more of their money to McKinley's campaign. 1896 was not close in the Electoral College, but Bryan makes the point in his book that he was close in a popular vote, 6.5 million to 7 million for McKinley. But more than that, a change of about 20,000 votes in the right places. California, where Bryan's campaign train didn't reach, Oregon, Indiana, North Dakota, West Virginia, Kentucky. The difference in Kentucky was 0.1%. The difference in California was less than 1%. Indiana, less than 3%. A change of 20,000 votes in these states would have made Bryan president by one electoral vote. Was it money? Perhaps. Was it simply the people's choice that, despite soaking the countryside with song, shouts, and she would have made their choice the same anyway? It's hard to say with 1896. There's more than just money at work here. There's some of the dynamics of any other presidential election before or since. As a home state candidate, the choice of Ohioan was critical because that was an important state. Bryan was only 4 points down in that state. He did everything he could to snatch it. Several of his train trips were made in Ohio. But you had a home state candidate. The Northeast was a lock for Republicans. And unlike Cleveland, Bryan never had a shot at New York. There was definitely a regional factor to 1896. Then there was a third-party split. gull Democrats who supported the incumbent president, President Cleveland, who was not supporting Bryan's candidacy, split from the party. Bryan had two running mates because there was the Populist Party backing him and then the Standard Democratic Party backing him. An awkward issue. There was arguments on both sides. For Bryan, it was silver money, 16 to 1, keeping tariff lows, and some people bought into that. For the Republican side, it was don't open the mints, open the mills. Don't try to solve the economy with money. Try to solve it by getting people back to work. Kind of a familiar campaign theme that you heard a lot this year. Yet using the argument that he'd only been defeated by the amount of money, Bryan was able to try two more times for the presidency and influence the Democratic Party for three decades. So there's been a lot of campaign fundraising in the past, and there's a lot of campaign fundraising now, and it's difficult to tell whether that money changes the election or not. I don't propose to tell you that. Here's an interesting point. Sumita Hudson writes on the My History Could Beat Up Your Politics Facebook site, "Personally, I think that the election probably helped the economy greatly. Also, it revitalizes people's sense of nationalism, which is good." Well, yeah, $6 billion being pumped into the economy. I mean, of course, it's largely going to Ohio and Florida TV ads, but I suppose if you're working in the media field, you like to see that amount of money injected into your industry. I'm not sure it had a huge effect on the economy at large. But in terms of revitalizing sense of nationalism, getting people involved in the election, I think the elections that recently where a lot of money has been spent are also high turnout elections. When we do have a turnout problem in the United States, so you can justify the amount of money being spent. It's very difficult if you have a competitive system to tell one side to stop spending money or the other. There's an incentive for each side to spend more, so I suspect it will keep going up. This turnout factor was similar in 1896. Turnout was very high in 1896 with two campaigns, one extremely well-funded, sending speakers and pamphlets all over the country, and one guy zipping around on a train, voice hoarse, spreading his message in a way that hadn't been done before. Because of that, 13 million voters, 2 million new voters than the previous election in 1892. So that could be seen as a benefit of all this campaign spending. Good, bad, ugly. Certainly there's issues that come up with campaign financing then and now. The one thing I would say, though, is to look at 2012 as an exceptional election. It probably was an expensive one, as things go, but to look at it as the only time in history that this proportionate amount of money was spent is probably a mistake. I want to thank you for listening. The website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. We do have the best of My History Can Beat Up Your Politics available for $9.99, 21 best episodes, or the whole archive of most of what we've recorded since 2006, hours and hours of podcasts, is available as well for $25.99. As we approach the new year here, I want to thank you for your support and thank you for listening.